today on the 21st show. It's well known global warming is changing our environment. Summer is lasting longer with more extreme heat days. We're seeing more severe storms, and Tornado Alley is moving east. All this is clearly affecting our bodies. Certainly we can feel the heat. But what is the warming climate doing to our minds? My guest today is neuroscientist turned climate writer Clayton Page Aldern. His book is called The Weight of Nature: How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our world is in a constant state of change, and many of those shifts we take for granted. The way winter gives way to spring, snow becomes rain, and birds, which had gone south with the sun, make their way back north and eventually do it all again. So the cycle continues. At least that's how it's supposed to be. But global warming means we are having new experiences with our weather, the land around us, and our entire planet. And just as those changes are affecting migratory birds, my guest for the hour today makes the case that we humans are also being buffeted by the storm. That's obvious, physically. It's hotter, it's colder, there's more rain and more drought. But beyond what we can see, hear, and feel with our senses, he says our warming climate is also affecting our brains. Clayton Page Aldern has described himself as a recovering neuroscientist. Today, he's a senior data reporter at the climate-focused news organization, GRIST. And his book is a Venn diagram of those interests. It's called The Weight of Nature: How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Aldern writes, "As the environment changes, you should expect to change too. It's the job of your brain to model the world as it is, and the world is mutating." I originally spoke with Aldern in May of this year. Because of that, we're not taking calls live today, but we do always appreciate hearing from you, so let us know what you think. The email address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, Clay, we want to understand what climate change is doing to us. Let's start with baseball. What can we learn from baseball?
I think that's a great place to start, not least because we've all witnessed something like this. There's a great study that came out from a couple of economists a few years ago that illustrated that as temperatures rise, baseball pitchers are more likely to hit batters of the opposite team with their pitches. And in particular, they're much more likely to do so in a kind of retaliatory fashion, right? If, for example,
is the Hammurabi effect, batter on, is that what you
Yeah, it is yeah. Indeed. It's kind of the eye for an eye of baseball, this retaliation. If somebody on their team has been hit in a similar manner, they're even more likely to do so in the heat. And so folks argue that this is a classic example of the relationship between heat and aggression, that as temperatures rise, we're more likely to retaliate, psychologically speaking, and indeed physically.
So this study, this was interesting. This was a 40-degree difference, right? An early spring day and one that's at the height of summer. You know, we don't have to go overboard with the exact numbers. But that sort of difference, it raised the probability of retaliation by about 5%. I mean, that doesn't sound like a huge difference, but how big a deal is that in the grand scheme of things?
Well, of course, it doesn't sound like a big difference. And I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't been paying a lot of attention to the differences in question. But the argument here is that they add up across whole populations, because it's not just baseball pitchers throwing particularly aggressive pitches in the heat. It's also the fact that we know that there are more incidents of domestic violence on hotter days, right? There are more incidents of online hate speech on hotter days, right? The probability of suicide rises. And so you can imagine that if there is indeed some mechanism linking higher ambient temperature to aggression and violence as modulated by the brain, summed across whole populations over time, those effects really add up.
All right, I want to take a step back. So that was getting narrow. But let's go back to the thesis of your book. I read from the introduction there. How are our world and our brains interconnected, for better and worse?
Yeah, that's a great question, Brian. You know, the job of the brain is to model the world, right? It's this organ that allows you, as somebody navigating the world, to have conscious access to an understanding of that environment around you, right? If we didn't have access to some kind of model of the world, we wouldn't be able to walk around. We wouldn't be able to interact with the rest of that world. So that's what the brain does, right? It is always reaching out. It's enmeshed in this environment, offering ourselves some kind of conscious access to an understanding of the way the world is structured. That is the job of the organ. And so you can imagine that as the world changes, right, as the climate changes, indeed other factors that are associated with our environment change, we ought to represent those changes accordingly with our brains, with this model of the world. And so, of course, it naturally follows that as the world changes, we must also change in kind, right? This organ inside of us is changing as well.
How has our understanding of climate change changed, global warming changed in the past few years, right? I mean, how much is this something getting to be where, you know, people feel like they're really noticing it day to day?
Well, I think perceptually speaking, right, in each of our own individual experiences of the world, something like climate change is becoming more and more obvious, right? We're seeing more and more record-breaking droughts and thousand-year floods and hurricanes and wildfires all around the world. It's becoming impossible to ignore. The question is, have we similarly wrapped our heads around what it is that the effects of the changing climate are having on the world writ large, on the economy, on healthcare systems, and indeed on ourselves? And this is where I think we're at a very new point in the science, where neuroscientists are coming to understand the fact that climate change isn't just about rising seas and indeed parched fields. It's also about the manners in which our internal neural landscapes are changing as well, that you have a changed climate almost reaching in and changing the structure of the brain, decisions that we make as a function of that statistical model of the world, the probability that we'll come into contact with a disease vector that affects the brain. All these findings that relate climate change and brain health, they're out there, but they're not understood as a unified field of research. And that's really the moment we're at right now.
Yeah, well, like you say, it is, we're still learning, right? And trying to make sense of this. When our producer, Christine, noted the one of her favorite examples was where researchers in Arizona looked into driver frustration, you know, behind an idling car, depending on the temperature, by measuring the honks, how long the honks lasted, how long it takes for the honking to start. I mean, talk about some of the challenges that go into actually making sense and doing this sort of research work.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we have all felt the effects of higher temperatures on cognition and behavior and our internal decision-making processes, right? If you've ever been irritated in the heat, you have felt this. I have certainly felt this. But at the same time, nobody's ever going to raise their hand and say, oh yeah, because it was 97 degrees today instead of 96 degrees today, you know, that extra degree Fahrenheit was the difference between me keeping my hands to myself and punching the person next to me on the bus. And so studying the effects in question, which are indeed very real, it demands a really careful statistical approach to population studies, right? We need to be sure that the effects that we're measuring have in fact been isolated and aren't the effect of, say, differences in income or differences in other sociodemographic factors that might be predictive of different types of behavior. And so, you know, so much of the problem in front of us in terms of characterizing these effects is a function of the fact that while we may feel the effects of a changing climate innately within us, measuring them is a different challenge. And doing so in a reliable manner at the level of the population demands very, very careful statistical methods.
Yeah. You know, I'm fascinated by this topic because, or this particular area of inquiry, because there's been all this coverage, it's been well documented that since the pandemic there, or at least during the height of the pandemic period, there was this rise in, you know, what some people term bad behavior. And that encompasses everything from people yelling at or physically assaulting flight attendants over mask reminders to vehicular manslaughter going up. And people driving recklessly, more recklessly. How do you disentangle, our political environment and fear and reaction to a pandemic to changing temperature and changing climate?
Well, you use really big data sets. And in particular, you build the type of data set that allows you as a researcher to compare the object of comparison to itself. And what I mean by that is, it doesn't make sense for us to draw conclusions about the relationship between, say, heat and cognitive capacity by comparing somebody who lives in a cold climate to somebody who lives in a temperate climate, or indeed in a warm climate, right? Instead, it makes sense to get some kind of measure of cognitive performance. Let's say a standardized test like the SAT, or indeed the PSAT, right, the pre-SAT, and compare a given student's attempts on that same exam over time, and take a look at what the temperature was. Because when you allow yourself to compare an individual to herself over time, you tend to be able to isolate the effects of temperature alone. That's of course, somewhat of a simplification, because you're going to need to use some other statistical tricks in order to isolate the effect in question. But generally speaking, this notion that what we're trying to do here is isolate the specific effects of an environmental factor on an individual, that's the core ball game here, right? When we talk about the horn honking, it's you know, a delightful study, but the fact that drivers are more likely to honk their horns in the heat, it should give us some curiosity, but it should not necessarily give us this causal truth. To get to some flavor of causal truth, you need to look at a study like that which was conducted by these researchers at the University of Ottawa, for example. They looked at immigration judges in the United States. And it turns out that if you compare a given immigration judge, again, to himself or herself over time, again, correcting for location, correcting for the leniency of the judge's decisions writ large, and just ask what types of decisions are they making as a function of temperature outside the courtroom, right, the types of temperatures that they may experience as they walk to work. It turns out that at higher temperatures, immigration judges in the United States are less likely to side with asylum applicants in their decisions. And so that's the kind of study, again, that should give us pause and consider the fact that there is indeed some kind of internal relationship, some kind of internal process that is being affected as a function of temperatures alone within a given person.
Yeah, and we can talk more toward the end of our conversation, the sort of news you can use idea. But I mean, that suggests all kinds of things about, you know, whether you're, if you have control over your sentencing or asylum application in court, or trying to get something out of a customer service agent, you know, time it to not be in the peak heat wave, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're talking with neuroscientist and environmental journalist Clayton Page Aldern, whose new book is called The Weight of Nature: How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. We have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I do want to talk about, you know, one of the reasons it's interesting to compare people over time and the same person is because we have this tendency of adaptation or forgetting. So let me just ask you, how long is summer?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, it kind of depends who you ask. But I would offer that it's about 3 months.
Didn't used to be that way, though, as you document in the book, right?
Indeed, it didn't. If you ask a climate scientist, they would say that, statistically speaking, the thing that we call summer, this tendency of days to look a certain way for a certain period of time, that has actually changed over the past decades. And in fact, for every decade that you've been alive, I think the estimate is that summer has lengthened by about 4 days in North America. And so that's a statement that should rattle us a little bit, because for those of us who haven't been alive for too many decades, of course, it's just an innately held truth that summer has always looked the way that we experience. But for those of us who've been alive for longer, maybe it's the kind of example that gives us pause and allows us to reflect and say, well, gosh, yeah, 40 years ago when I was growing up, or 50 years ago when I was growing up, it did seem to be the case that there was maybe a 2 week period near the end of quote unquote summer that was actually maybe a little more like autumn, you know? And those little perceptual flips, those little perceptual switches, they're happening everywhere all the time within us, and they're happening unconsciously. The fact that our brains are constantly trying again to model the world around us, right? Mm-hmm. And so our definition of summer, as it were, is predicated on our experience of the season as it currently exists. Your brain is kind of always there whispering, hey, yeah, it's always felt this way. Summer has always looked like this. But we know by looking at the empirical temperature records, the empirical climatological records, that it has not always looked this way.
All right. And we're gonna sorry to interrupt you. We're going to have to pause there, and we will continue this conversation in a moment. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our conversation today is with Clayton Page Aldern, who's a senior data reporter at the climate-focused news site Grist. He's also the author of a book called The Weight of Nature: How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. It's all about how climate change and global warming isn't just affecting the world around us, it's affecting us, too. We first spoke with Aldern in May of this year. Because our program's on tape, we're not taking calls live today, but you can let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121. Let's pick up where we left off. So before the break, we were talking about how long summer is, how it's gotten longer. I think the number you cited in the book is about 4 days longer for every 10 years we've been alive. For me, that puts it going on 3 weeks of more summer that we're experiencing. And you write that scientists estimate it could last almost half the year by 2100. Winter would be less than 2 months at that point. At least this is in the Northern Hemisphere. So let's talk about that idea of our perception and how that changes. You have a sentence in the book, "The climate can't change if you don't know what it felt like to begin with." Talk about that, this idea of climate as an idea rather than something that's sort of definite and tangible.
Yeah, gladly. No, I think it's such an essential point. Weather is real, right? When you stick your hand out when it's raining and water appears on your palm, that's a very real thing. Climate is very different. Right. Climate is an idea. It is defined by the language of science. Right. It is often expressed in statistics, for example, averages. Right. Often we talk about climate as average weather. But the fact that it is defined by statistics should suggest to us that this is a construct. This is a human idea. It's an idea that defines our expectations of the way the world is supposed to look. And so if you take a moment and pause and reflect on this suggestion that there's nothing real about the climate in the same way that something like weather or indeed a coffee cup has this real referent in the world. And you accept this premise that the climate is effectively a figment of human culture. It's a figment of the imagination, a well-defined figment, right? One that we can articulate very precisely, but we articulate it arbitrarily. We come up with these definitions as a society. That should give us pause, because it should direct our attention to the fact that everything related to the climate is also related to our expectations of the world, right? If our definition of the climate is this is the societal expectation of what the world is supposed to look like, then it's also necessarily true that as those definitions must necessarily change, right? As the climate changes, it should also be true that our expectations internally change as well.
So this all kind of brings to mind a conversation we had on the program a few months ago about how a changing winter is affecting a lot of our traditions, big and small, here in the Midwest. You make the case in the book that a lot of us, I guess as a society, we're actually forgetting how things used to be in the climate around us. What do we know about why this happens?
Well, it's written into so many of the manners in which we interact with the world around us. By way of example, the notion of a climate normal in climate science is a statistical definition that defines a point of comparison. So we can say, hey, here's what the climate looked like 50 years ago. Here's what it looks like now. But at some point, you do indeed need to put down the goalposts and say, when we talk about the baseline in question, here's what we're talking about. Again, it's an arbitrary distinction. These climate normals consist of, I think, 30-year periods in many cases that average out rainfall patterns, temperature patterns, et cetera, to provide a societal expectation, right? A scientific expectation that we can then use as a baseline to compare our current experience of the weather to, in order to decide what, if anything, has changed at all. But those climate normals, they're updated over time. And they're updated for good reason, because again, we use them for more than just climate science per se, right? We use climate normals in agriculture to understand the types of planting patterns that we might want to follow through with in order to be most responsive to the climate around us, right? If we were acting on the climate normals as defined by the 1930s, right, we would be acting agriculturally as if we were in the Dust Bowl, for example, which doesn't make any sense. We need to update these climate normals in order to have some sense of what indeed the world looks like. But the world is changing. And so there's a little bit of amnesia baked into the pie here, such that every time you update the climate normal, it seems to be the case that the world has always looked this way. Right. And this is just one practice that we have in climate science and indeed with respect to our psychology that I think encourages us to tell ourselves that the world has always looked the way that it has. Another example comes from the notion of shifting baseline syndrome, the fact that you've only been alive as long as you've been alive. So as you interact with other people, as you interact with the world, indeed, for example, if you're a scientist and you're taking baseline measurements relevant to your scientific field, you're really often only doing so with respect to what constitutes normal for you. You're doing so with respect to your definition of normality. And because generations continue to crop up along with the march of time, it means that the definition of normal, the psychological normal, changes as well. Every new crop of scientists is going to take their own personal experience and say, well, this is what constitutes the baseline for me. I'm going to now compare my observations against that baseline to determine whether or not things are out of sorts. And yet this shifting baseline syndrome infects so many
of the decisions we make, the judgments we make about the world, scientific and otherwise. So I think there are many processes psychologically and scientifically that lend themselves to indeed effectively forgetting what the world used to look like. And psychologically, it means that we're left in this position that we tend to feel that the normality that we're experiencing now is something that we've always experienced. And that's just not correct.
Is there a way in which that's a good thing, right? I mean, human adaptability is one of our strengths as a species, I think. You know, somebody might say, you know what, I don't like the winter. I'm actually glad we're going to have more warm months. What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem is that indeed humans are adaptable, but we're not infinitely adaptable. And so, yes, of course it makes sense for us to be modeling the world as it exists with our brains and our technology and our scientific instruments and ideas. It would be foolish if we remembered everything that we experience exactly as it existed, right? If we had nothing but perfect memory, we wouldn't be able to get anything done, not least because our judgments about the world would be based in the past. And so you need, in terms of evolution, you need some kind of active mechanism that competes with memory in order to ensure that you, as the organism navigating the world, are best positioned to navigate the world as it actually exists. And so that's what forgetting does, right? Forgetting is an evolutionarily tuned mechanism that allows organisms to adjust their expectations of the world. So basically, they match reality. And so it's good that we can adapt accordingly. The problem, of course, is indeed if we forget the baseline in question and we assume that these adaptive capacities, forgetting among them, but also the biophysical adaptive capacities we have to adjust our relationship with extreme heat, right? If we just assume that adaptation is going to save us as the world changes, we're fooling ourselves because humans are not capable of adapting to the extreme temperatures and extreme meteorological conditions that we know are going to continue to increase as a function of a changing climate. We're just not evolutionarily suited for that.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest today is a self-described recovering neuroscientist and a current environmental journalist, Clayton Page Aldern. He's also the author of a book called The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Once again, we originally had this conversation of May in this year, so keep that in mind going into this next question as we talk a bit about the weather. I want to get back to the heat. I'm looking at a weather app on my phone in Urbana, where our home station is based. High today is forecast to be 85 degrees, 19 degrees above the average daily high. What, and we talked about that baseball example and the sort of eye for an eye rule about trying to hit the opposing team if one of your players gets hit with a pitch. What do we know? What do we understand about how and why heat affects our brains in this way?
Well, we're beginning to learn a lot more. Classically, when we've asked this question, we've tried to do so with the tools of psychology. We've said, what is it about heat that primes people toward aggression or indeed toward impulsivity? And the answer seems to be there's something about heat that suggests that when we as people come into contact with other people or indeed some kind of critical situation, a critical problem that needs to be solved, in the heat, we're more likely to interpret these interactions with other people, for example, as aggressive, even if it's a totally benign interaction. And when you overinterpret a social interaction, you are more likely to respond as if you've been slighted. You are more likely to respond aggressively as well. And so that's where escalation takes off. Now, the question is, okay, fine. So heat lends itself to overinterpretation and some kind of outsized aggression response, some kind of impulsive response in the face of these critical interactions. But why, right? The psychological method doesn't necessarily answer the why. And this is where the neuroscientists come into play. And what they're beginning to find is that heat effectively acts as an additional cognitive load. And what I mean by that is you have a certain fixed capacity in your brain in terms of what it can do at once. And this is not the kind of statement that says like, oh, you only use 10% of your brain or whatever. That is pseudoscience. What I'm talking about is the fact that you have strict biophysical limits in terms of metabolism, in terms of the energy that cells need in order to function, in order to keep themselves cool, for example, right? You have biophysical limits that need to be adhered to if you are going to continue to persist in time at all, if you are going to continue to survive. And so in extreme heat, when your brain begins to heat up, it needs to take some of that metabolic capacity. It needs to take some of the energy it uses for things like critical thinking and decision making and executive function and effectively devote it to other processes that are used to cool the brain tissue itself. So you see this overworking of effectively executive control and a resulting over-influence of some of the more emotionally charged regions of the brain, right? You have in the front of your cortex, right, the most evolutionarily new swaths of brain matter. You have a region of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And the DLPFC is the rational decider in the brain. It is the most quote-unquote objective decision-making tool we have. It's often balancing those emotional inputs to the rest of the PFC that come from places like the amygdala, for example. Now, in the heat, what we know is that the DLPFC is overworked, right? It's overworked in the manners that we just discussed. And what that means is that you have this undue kind of outsized influence coming from those emotional sectors, coming from places like the amygdala, influencing the rest of the prefrontal cortex as it makes decisions. And if your decisions are a function of emotion, as opposed to a function of rationality, for example, psychologically speaking, they're going to look a lot more impulsive. And indeed, that is what we see.
Just a couple of minutes till we need to take a break here. But, you know, I'm listening to you say that, and I'm also thinking of how angry we've become in our politics in America. I wonder, do you think climate change has exacerbated political polarization in America?
Well, that's such a fabulous question. I mean, I tend to think that political polarization has much more to do with the manners in which we respond to the climate problem than the other way around. And at the same time, I mean, these are subtle effects, and they creep across generations and time and indeed borders, right? Climate change is this force that acts almost in a universal capacity insofar as everybody with a brain is subject to the effects we're talking about. It is certainly the case that some populations, right, some subpopulations of people are going to be more affected, comparatively speaking, by climate change, right? There are dozens of vulnerable communities out there for whom the effects in question are going to be most extreme. But broadly speaking, everybody has a brain. And so to the extent that climate change bears on brain health, it is true that this is a series of effects, a certain public health suite of effects that have been invisibly acting on the population for decades already. And I think we're only just now beginning to reckon with the scale and magnitude of the problem in question, and really just now beginning to get a sense of all the manners in which these processes have infiltrated our culture.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, and it's one of those things where obviously you'd rather be in central Illinois than the Maldives in the next 100 years, I guess, when we're thinking about the changing climate. But it is something we're all going to have to reckon with. All right. We are going to take another break. We'll continue our conversation with Clayton Page Aldern when we return. His book is The Weight of Nature: How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about how global warming and the world we're inheriting is affecting us, and our brains in particular. We're talking with science journalist Clayton Page Aldern, senior data reporter at the climate-focused news site Grist, the author of the book The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. We originally spoke with Clay on the program back in May, and again, you'll hear that reflected as we talk about the weather through the rest of the show today. You can let us know how you think we are doing on the program by emailing talk@21stshow.org. All right, back to the conversation as we went to the phones. Bill is on line 4 from Springfield, where it is forecast to be 16 degrees above the average daily high today in the middle of spring. Bill, hope you're keeping cool. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome. Thank you for this program. Question I have has to do with what can we do to our brains in terms of knowledge about educating us to the point where we finally agree with the most insightful environmental scientists who really know what's going on. I just was wondering if you'd use the insight that some of these scientists have as a sort of a template for the rest of us to, you know, follow. It seems as though we'd be more likely to make the necessary changes in order to avert the utter disaster that these scientists know is going to happen. I'd just like to know, how are we going to change our minds?
All right, Bill, thank you so much for that question. Yeah, Clay, go ahead.
Yeah, it's such an important question, Bill. You know, I have a couple short answers that come to mind. Listen, first, we've spent a fair amount of time over the course of this conversation talking about the behavioral effects of climate change, the cognitive effects of climate change. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about all the other manners in which climate change acts on brain health, right? And by way of example, it's increasing the habitable range of disease vectors like ticks and mosquitoes that cause brain diseases like cerebral malaria, you know, and yellow fever, the kinds of stuff you really don't want to get a diagnosis of. And so when I think about solutions, when I think about coming to terms with these effects, I'm not just thinking about the neuroscience per se, because while I will advocate for a handful of cognitive behavioral approaches to the solutions, they're not going to prevent a pandemic per se, right? They're not going to prevent the outbreak of these infectious diseases that are spreading as a function of a changing climate. And so to those effects, I think about a societal response that necessarily grapples with them on their own terms. And what I mean by that is, as we as a society begin to wrap our heads around the neurological effects of the climate crisis, I think it's essential that we indeed are pricing them accordingly. We're integrating these effects into our cost-benefit analyses as policymakers when we make decisions about climate action. If we are not integrating these findings into our policymaking, right, if we do not have that awareness as a society, we're walking into the future with a blind eye. So first, I think there's something to be said about merely accounting for the effects in question, because no policymaking institution is doing that right now. On an individual level, I think something that comes up for me a lot, and I just hinted at this when I offered the other answer, is that awareness as manifested personally in the view of the neuroscientists often takes the form of something like mindfulness practices or something like cognitive behavioral therapy, right? The kind of mental health counseling that, broadly speaking, affords a patient, right? Affords somebody who's grappling with some type of trauma or some type of experience that they're struggling to process in the world. These are the types of techniques that allow us as individuals to notice the responses that we're having to the stressors in question, to the traumatic event in question, notice those responses, but then ask some critical questions about why we're having those responses. Or in the case of mindfulness, for example, notice and accept the response in question, but then be able to move on, right? And move on to a place of noticing other effects, right? Noticing the rest of what's going on in our brains and bodies. And the reason that I think cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness and all of these phrases and practices that I think are often spoken about in a kind of new age manner are actually quite effective and appropriate in this context is because indeed the neuroscience would suggest that they are, right? We know from studies of people, for example, who have experienced extreme mental trauma as a function of a wildfire, for example, or indeed, you know, in the case of students who are readily distractible as a function of the heat, when you institute something like a mindfulness protocol, when you institute a series of breathwork exercises or indeed internal mindful awareness practices, you see that distractibility disappear. You see with presence, with this mindful presence, effectively a neurological response that looks a lot like the functional connectivity that is erased as a function of the climate stressors in question. And so I think that, you know, long story short, there's a societal awareness that needs to be instituted here, but also a very practical and readily actionable personal awareness that we need to take with us as we move forward.
Another caller is on the line. Donna is calling from Peoria on line 4. Donna, thank you for calling in.
You're welcome.
So I understand you experience migraine headaches.
I have been a migraine patient for years, and barometric pressure changes are one of my migraine triggers. And I have noticed in the past, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, as the frequency and intensity of the storms has increased, the frequency and intensity of my migraines have increased right along with them.
Yes. Yes. And this is one example among many, right? We do indeed know, right? We know from both anecdotal and epidemiological data that what you're saying is exactly right, that your experience is exceptionally valid here, right? We know that headache data, migraine data, all these types of headache disorders that are experienced, you know, I think affecting something on the order of 14 or 15% of Americans, they're associated with environmental factors, right? Relative humidity is associated with migraine onset in warm weather. I think air pollution in the form of traffic pollutants are associated with migraine onset, right? And it's not just a story of headache disorders. We also know that warm weather, right, hot, extreme temperatures increase the likelihood that people with neurodegenerative diseases or forms of dementia, for example, are hospitalized because a lot of the dementia disorders and indeed neurodegenerative disorders in question, first and foremost among people, before anything else happens, affect their thermoregulatory systems. And some of the drugs that these folks might be taking in order to regulate these thermoregulatory responses, they're less effective at higher temperatures. And so you have this this kind of double problem there, where people who are already susceptible to extreme conditions in the form of temperature are doubly susceptible because it may be the case that the drugs that they're taking to help modulate those effects are less effective in the heat. And this is true for so many neurological conditions. We know that there's a relationship between hot weather and incidence of seizure in epileptic patients. We know that more people are likely to end up in the emergency department for a handful of other neurological conditions in the heat. We know that heat exposure during early pregnancy, for example, increases the likelihood of babies being born with an increased risk for something like anorexia or something like schizophrenia. And so there are so many environmental factors, Donna, you're totally right, that are influencing neurological conditions in a manner that affects our everyday life that we are just not at all paying attention to on a societal level.
Donna, thank you so much for that call. We really appreciate it.
No problem.
Clay, just a few minutes left in our time together. You know, there's a spectrum of people who write and think about climate change, ranging from the sort of doom, you know, people who write articles and books with the word extinction in the title, to thinking of Hannah Ritchie's new book that was literally titled Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet. Where do you see yourself on that spectrum of hopeful to hopeless, to take it where you will?
Well, I tend to be a little bit suspicious of hope. I think that hope can breed a kind of complacency if we find ourselves too comfortable in it, right? If we just imagine that everything is going to get better, imagining isn't going to do the trick. We actually have to act. And so when I think about the hope question and my vision of the future, yes, we're talking about some really serious stuff here. I do think that in terms of the climate problem, it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I'm interested in articulating a kind of vision for a livable future that I desire, right? I do think it's possible to do so. And I think it's possible upon articulating that vision to reach out and grab it. I think if we are motivated by desire as opposed to blind hope, we'll be moving much more actively in the right direction. And all this evidence, all of this new science that suggests there's a whole field of neurological and cognitive and behavioral effects coming to us as a function of climate change, to me, there's some positivity to be found in those relationships as well, right? If it's true that the environment is reaching in across this boundary between self and world, if we are so readily influenced by the world around us at the most intimate level, that to me is a suggestion that this idea of the separate self that we so readily cling to, it's kind of just a fallacy, right? We are enmeshed in our environments. We are a part of a greater world. And to me, the visceral statement that you can make, that kind of internalized statement that you can make that feels real as a function of this evidence, that's a very, very powerful statement. To me, coming to terms with this enmeshment, coming to terms with the intimacy of our relationship with the environment around us, that gives me a sense of purpose. That gives me a desire to indeed not just be affected by the world around me, but to reach out and do what I can to affect it as well.
Clay, thanks so much for making the time to be with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Clayton Page Aldern is the author of The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Available now at a bookstore near you. Coming up on tomorrow's show, for many years, the invention of the board game Monopoly was credited to a man named Charles Darrow, but its roots actually go back to a woman born in Macomb, Illinois. We'll open up the box on that history with author Mary Pilon, who wrote a history of the game. Her book is called The Monopolists: Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. Plus, with an epidemic of food allergies, doctors recommend that parents expose kids to peanuts early on. But a survey shows most parents don't know about that advice. We'll talk about the implications of that. And that's all the time we have for our show today. Before we go, will you consider joining our texting group? You put the public in public radio. We love sharing your comments and questions on the show. You can join by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You can find that and every other way to contact us, including our voicemail line, on our website, which is 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. We've got all our past shows there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcasts, or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or even YouTube. The 21st Show is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Stephanie Mosqueda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.